Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin. Each episode, I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalize on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them that it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a breakup. Games often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, as I search for my perfect console. My guest today is the American co-creator of one of the longest-running and most popular independent games yet made. In high school, he and his older brother designed adventure games based on fantasy and science fiction stories that they invented together. He taught himself computer programming and received 15 offers to enroll in PhD math programs. At Stanford University, he and his brother continued to work on a procedural adventure game called Dwarf Fortress, in which players guide successive generations of dwarves to build and maintain a fortress. He quit university to work on the game full-time, and in 2011, the New York Times described an early version as perhaps the most complex video game ever made. Dwarf Fortress became his life's work, with a vast and committed cult following, but it remained a work in progress until last December, when version 1.0 finally launched and promptly sold 500,000 copies. Welcome, Tarn Adams.
Hey!
Well, 2 decades is a really long time to work on a single video game, so what is your emotional state right now? You know, you've worked on this thing for all of your adult life and now it's finally finished, is it?
Oh, no, it's not finished at all. In fact, I mean, I wouldn't even call this the 1.0 release. It would have been like the 0.5 release, but we didn't want to release a 0.0 anything game commercially. So now it's called the 5.0 release. We're just, it's like Firefox or something, right? These web browsers that just have these ridiculously high version numbers. So that's where we're at.
But I suppose there's a difference when you, like you say, sort of the game has been supported just by donations from players for a very long time, and now it's available for people to buy. Did that feel like a milestone for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were building toward it for like 3 years or however long we've been working on this. Just redoing the interface of the game, or just paying our debt, our technical interface debt that we had been building up, you know, for 20 years.
Right. Were you surprised by how many copies it sold?
It was kind of, surprising and not surprising in the sense that we had wish list numbers, right? That you could kind of just see growing, and you can see, oh, this is actually going to do okay, probably, right? We had something like 800,000 wish lists when we launched.
Gosh.
And those were just growing over the years. There was never really a big spike where they grew. It just was a slow, ever since we announced and made the Steam page, you know, back in whenever it was, 2019 or something like that. It's just been slowly growing, and we're like, well, how is this going to convert, you know? And it did well. It did well. I mean, you really have no idea. I mean, there's people, of course, put these charts up on these sort of game developer websites and so forth that say, like, well, sometimes the conversion is, you know, 1% of your wish list will convert. Sometimes it's 250%. And, you know, we ended up around, you know, I don't know what it would be, the 30% mark or 40 in the first week, which is what they're talking about. And
that's pretty good.
Right in the middle. And that's enough for us. Yeah, it's fine to be a normal game for once, you know?
I mean, it doesn't cost anything for someone to add a game to their wish list. It's so, you know, the 40% who actually then, when the game's out, decide to pay for it, that seems pretty good to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was more than we needed. So we're still ecstatic over here.
Okay, so this is a slightly taboo question, but we happen to like be talking on a week when there have been lots of stories in the news about how much money the game has made in the last month, because the information, I suppose, because of the way Steam works, is somewhat public. Yeah, how do you feel about people having those discussions in public about something that most people consider quite a private matter?
Well, for us, because we were doing donations, we actually found it beneficial to post our monthly earnings, and we've been doing so for, you know, maybe 15 years.
Why did you do that?
It kind of lets people know how we're doing, and that, you know, things aren't great when they aren't great, which is when you really need people to show up. And they did every single time. It's just kind of throwing yourself out there. And people can also kind of misinterpret the numbers, because our numbers were all kind of pre-tax and split between two people. So people could kind of have an idea that it was more than they thought it was, and et cetera. But all in all, it was fine. And people could see the dips, and then people could also see the bumps during, say, Christmas time or a big launch of some version or other. And so it turned out well for us. And actually, over sitting on our forum right now 2 days ago, because that's when the money came in, we just put up one of these posts that was our numbers. And I mean, I could just read the last three entries. It says November 14,000, December 15,600, January 7.2 million.
That's a pretty good January.
Yeah, they were like, oh, you all just did 38 years of donations in a month. I'm like, yep, that's how it turned out.
Wow. Yeah, I feel slightly icky just even asking the question, but I think it is interesting, you know, especially I've always been kind of interested in particularly indie game devs, because, you know, the people making Call of Duty, like, no one really questions their success. But if it's like a really small outfit, it feels like this stuff's a bit more scrutinized. So I appreciate you being honest, but it seems like you're very open anyway with your players and with the public about it.
Sure, yeah. And I find it's both useful and not useful to other independent developers to have these discussions, because like Dwarf Fortress is just not really a translatable case, right? I mean, it's just super unusual. But at the same time, just talking about it, like, oh yeah, the conversions actually kind of work how you expect and stuff like that. I mean, people derive a lot of benefit from that. Those discussions we certainly did leading up to this, knowing, you know, what does you know, not just 800,000 wish lists, but what would 5,000 wish lists mean? Like, what does it actually mean? And you can have some sense of that, and that's kind of nice to kind of temper your expectations and prepare for the future.
One last question on this, and then I promise I'll move on. But you know, the I suppose the reason for publishing your numbers over the previous years, as you say, has been to sort of indicate to people when you need a bit of help, and so that they can pitch in and support the project and ensure its survival, all of that stuff. That's obviously now changed, right? Because I suppose people would assume that you're now fine to run the game forever. Are you worried that it might change how people deal with you, both professionally and maybe in your personal life as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you hear all kinds of stories. I mean, especially about people like lottery winners and stuff just being straight up killed by family members and so forth, right? So it's like...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, anything could happen, right?
let's hope it won't be that dark.
No. Who knows, right? Who knows? It's always interesting to go to like a biography or even a Wikipedia article or something. You get to the end and something has to happen. We'll see what we get.
How are you trying to keep your feet on the ground through all of this?
Yeah, I just haven't tried yet. It's still too early, especially like I say, it just transferred a couple of days ago. So when we saw it's the funniest thing, like we were trying to get the money transferred and like our bank manager wasn't authorized to do it and their manager wasn't authorized to do it. Their manager wasn't authorized to do it and their manager wasn't authorized to do it. But when they went five people up, they're like, okay, we can, put it in the computer, blah, blah, blah. It'll take a few hours. And then one of the people's like, or they could just use the phone app.
And that just worked first time.
And we did.
That seems like it might be problematic.
Yeah.
Little tech loophole there.
Yeah.
So you got takeout that first night, I take it.
Yeah. No, we did. We ate some just kind of what our regular celebratory food would be, which is not that inventive. We really need to think of, we just aren't in the proper mindset. We tip well anyway. Yeah, I don't know. We aren't used to it yet and don't know how we should be thinking about it really, because there's also the project to think about, right?
Of course, yeah.
We're paying programmers and artists and all that kind of stuff now too. So it's not all free money.
No, of course.
I mean, especially when you see all like these tech layoffs and stuff, people just kind of like was it because they were overextended, et cetera, or was it just some random shareholders? I have no idea. But you can kind of see now, you're going to get one lump. Maybe no more lumps, who knows, right? We don't know how this works yet. It's still too early. But now that lump needs to be managed, not just for us, but for the future of the project for like another 20 years or something, right?
Maybe hold off the metaverse version of Dwarf Fortress for a little bit.
Yeah, there's the whole topic.
Okay, so the theme of the podcast is I'm asking you to pick the five games you want to install in your very own fictional games console and market to the world. Could you tell us about your first pick, which I believe is from 1982? When did you first encounter the game and tell us about it?
Yeah, so my first pick is Cosmic Ark. This is from 1982. We had it on Atari. I don't know if it existed on other consoles and so forth, but this was one of my brother and I's favorite games. This is kind of sort of representative for us of our console era, which expanded Ataris and there was a VIC-20, Nintendos and things like that. But this game was special because You're flying around in a little spaceship shooting asteroids, but then you have to go to a planet and pick up two, of course it's two because it's an arc, pick up two little life forms with a tractor beam while you're being shot at by lasers. But the thing for us as little kids was this is the first game that we ever saw where there'd just be some random creature on a planet and then you go to another planet and they look different. And so there's there's different creatures now. And then you go to the next one and there's a whole third sprite for a different creature and they just keep changing. And it just kind of lit some kind of, we're just in the post-toddler phase, but not too far past it. And it just kind of lit this spark of possibility in us. But I wanted to shout out where it all began.
So, and it's quite interesting. It was made by the same guy that made Missile Command, didn't it? Which is the game all about nuclear, sort of the nuclear war. And I remember reading that he had nightmares when he made that game because it was built right in the middle of the nuclear crisis between Russia and America, wasn't it?
Cosmic Ark is actually the sequel to the Atlantis game where a city is obliterated
right
again. And then the little spaceship escapes at the end. And I mean, it was kind of, I don't know if this was one of the first sort of story sequels or something like that, because you're playing this little spaceship right in the second game.
Oh, okay. So it's like basically what happens when you flee Earth after a nuclear attack type
thing.
Yeah.
And then you have to go get these animals, I guess, from different planets to reveal. I don't actually know. I was too young and I didn't go look it up because I didn't really want to spoil it for myself. Spoil like this childhood experience. I don't know what the story was. I don't know why you were taking these animals. Were you going to like breed up different animals and start anew on some planet possibly?
Your household, you say you were very, very young when you first started playing this game. it was quite a computer-y household, wasn't it? Why was that?
So my father was one of the people that sort of introduced computer analysis to wastewater treatment. Every industry gets computerized at some point, right? And that was happening in the 70s and into the 80s, and doing like cluster analysis on different kind of readouts for, you know, what's going on in the activated sludge vat or whatever right now.
He was trying to write computer programs that would tell you when there was, you know, strain on the particular sewage system in particular areas.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff that you can visualize it. It had a visual component. The operators who are not, you know, computer trained could see when something was wrong. Rather than have to go through and do like hours of analysis or something that would just, I mean, sometimes you'd miss it or sometimes it'd be too late. I'm kind of making up horror stories about sewage treatment plants in my mind right now. I'm sure it wasn't always that bad, right? Sometimes you just want to get within regulations or whatever, I'm sure. So that work came home, fortunately, not in that form, but in the form of just an interest in computers and my father knowing that this was just going to be how the world was from now on. It was already changing, and he wanted, you know, the kids to be ready for this new world, and thought, you know, well, the best way to get them into this is to get them games and also teach them how to program.
So you were not only early adopters, but also sort of young programmers.
Yeah, basic from... As long as I can remember, it's tied into learning to read, learning to add. I kind of knew what variables were right at the same time.
Really?
So, yeah, it was a strange hitting algebra, and they like take you, took like three or four of us out of grade school, the kind of kids that were going to get placed in an advanced math class, and set us aside, and we're like, okay, the variable is a bucket, and so forth. Like these discussions to try and get you into how algebra works. And it was the strangest conversation because I've been around this stuff for like 8 years now or something. It was really weird.
Did you find that you had more knowledge than some of the people that were trying to teach you, certainly in terms of computer programming?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's strange. It's just a weird experience going through school like that with just a particular skill. I'm sure it happens to a lot of people that are in different... like it probably happens in music classes and stuff like that, right? Just strange things that children can be good at. And I'm sure there's lots of kids with experiences like that. But for me, yeah, computers, it was weird being in computer classes and being like set aside. It's like Tarn's going to have that side of the room and just work on typing at, you know, 90 words per minute or whatever while the rest of us learn where the F key is and stuff.
Your childhood was fairly peripatetic. You were moving all over the place, Washington, California, New Hampshire, and all over... I presume because of your father's work. What effect did that have on you and your brother, do you think?
I think we're still dealing with that, actually, because, yeah, it puts a strain and obviously breaks friendships, things like that. But you also kind of see more of the, at least the country, right? We didn't move around the world or anything, but I'd say New Hampshire is quite different from California.
Sure.
In about every way, pretty much. Not just snow, but the town we moved to was like something. It was like the Back to the Future town, kind of. There was like one movie theater, and it was kind of living in the 50s still in a lot of ways. And compared to California, which was, you know, California. I don't know if it's really, I mean, it hasn't really had effects, I think, on how I form friendships now and stuff. But I don't feel like I have the kind of solid foundation that other people feel like they're standing on sometimes when they talk about their childhood communities or people that they know, or they have like a Facebook that's just full of people, right? And stuff that they had, people that recontact them or that kind of thing. I don't even have a Facebook account because it's just, it didn't feel like there was something to connect back to.
You obviously have a close relationship with your brother. You've worked together for many years. And I suppose part of the effect of moving around was that it pushed you guys closer together. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I'd say so. The first move, yeah, when we kind of, you know, all we had was each other when we got to New Hampshire. We you know, formed friendships again, obviously, but we kind of just also, like every day after school, go make computer games. During vacations, go make computer games.
Really?
You know, I still have my old basic games. We have like 800 of them.
800?
Something like that, yeah. And they're just, I'm not talking about full games, obviously, because you can't produce 800 full games in your life, but you can produce a lot of garbage. And we did.
Sure. Okay, I mean, I suppose I would ask what's the first, but what's actually the one that sticks out in your mind as being something that you felt was good after you'd finished making it?
I'd say there was the Drag Slayer game, obviously, that Dwarf Fortress was ultimately sprang out of.
Yes, Dragon Slayer.
But this was like a D&D RPG. It had hit points, which were for us. But it worked well. I mean, it was fun. You kind of go through these sequence of battles, fighting monsters and then dragons every 10th battle and so forth. There was equipment you could find and all kinds of strange little Easter eggs of the kind that children would put in. Like when you kill a monster, there's like a 10% chance that you'll have to fight maggots that come up off its body and stuff like that.
Very creative.
And there was a whole strange system of like, we never had IQ tests or anything. We never put any stock in that stuff. But for some reason, it seemed to be because wizards in D&D were always the smart ones. We put in like this IQ measurement and you'd get these intelligence potions. And as you drank them, your IQ would go up. And once it hit 200, you could start casting spells. But also if you got hit in the head, you lost IQ points. And so you'd kind of gain and lose access to the spell system as you proceeded through the game. And it was just a strange, yeah, product of like an 11-year-old or whatever.
Not many wizards on the American football team being smacked in the head all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it chokes the brain. The CTE that one definitely sticks out. There's all kinds of other ones too. Just these weird sort of. It was the whole era in California with gangster rap and stuff coming up and the beginnings of GTA style games and stuff like that. Not GTA itself, but just these shareware games that would float around. And we took our hand at that just based on our like,
oh, you did?
Yeah. Just in school, just text games, right. About like school stuff and just putting our friends, inserting them in, but it's all violent and
right.
Just stupid.
Text adventure for the LA riots type thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. Yes. They call it juvenilia for a reason, right?
So no, of course. Yeah. And I mean, you can only imagine writing 800 games, even incomplete ones, that's a pretty intense training, isn't it, to be a game developer?
Yeah, yeah, and you learn, and it was great to hit the technical limits, right? We had like these animated movies that would go on and on and on and on and on, and they had so many frames in them that you have to like chain to the next program because it couldn't compile on the compilers we were using, and so you'd kind of chain 30 of them together. And then when we started programming in C and stuff, like we'd hit new limits, and the computers, of course, were adding this many megabytes to the hard drives at the time, and then they had RAM and stuff, and it was going up, and we'd always hit the limits. It fortunately taught us how to let programs die well. And how to stop them from dying eventually, which was where we got to with Dwarf Fortress finally.
You mean like memory leaks and things,
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, just everything that can go wrong. And then you learn, right, to optimize, you learn to use your resources wisely, even though these days it doesn't seem like you have to a lot of the time. We still have a lot of those instincts that have kept the game alive for so long.
Let's come to your second game. Can you tell me about this? Do you remember when you first played it?
So this is the game Beast. Beast is a fascinating, fantastic game from 1984, and I'd recommend any person who plays Minecraft, for instance, can go look at this. Maybe you just find a video of or whatever, and kind of see what people were thinking way back then about blocks and moving around in these blocky environments and stuff. So this was a shareware game, but it was kind of a donation where they just kind of say, hey, send us $20, but you just play the game, do whatever you want.
Wait, where did you hear about it, by the way?
This is, I'm assuming now, because of course this is still when I'm young, so the memories aren't perfect here, but I'm assuming this was a BBS game. So we got it off a bulletin board. There was like the Walnut Creek bulletin board in California where you just dial in with Q modem, using your modem hooked into a phone line in the wall, and makes all those terrifying noises that people may remember or see in a movie or something. And then you're suddenly on this what feels these days like some kind of pirate website, because you could just list games and download them, but they're all, I mean, these are generally at least freeware, and you just throw them on your disk, occasionally. We didn't get viruses. We only maybe got one or two viruses because it just wasn't as big a deal back then.
Right.
But we just snagged hundreds of these things. Beast was one of these first games that we played in a way that's probably not what the creator of the game had anticipated or expected, but you never know, where you have these beasts, right? There's these little H's, and they wander around, and you can squish them. You can push blocks. They wander around a blocky, it's not really a maze because it's sparser than that, but there's blocks everywhere, and you can push them. You're the only one that can push them at first. And so you get them between two blocks, you squish them, and you move to the next level. Then you start getting bigger beasts that have to be squished in these special squares that look kind of like lava that don't move. And then there's also beasts that can hatch from eggs, and then they can start pushing. What my brother and I would do, though, is just kind of play on a lower level, where there just be a few of the little H's running around, and then try and separate out as much of the map as we could with a little wall and have as much building material on the left side, say, of the right screen, and just build like little rooms and,
oh my gosh,
and pretend that we had a little place here where these little beasts were running on the outside. The game had some safeguards against this kind of behavior, just to time out the game. So after, you know, some minutes, the beasts would start to kind of shake and explode and blow up the sides of the little house that we were making. And so we kind of, right, eventually you get to the ones where they're pushing and then it's kind of destroys the house and so forth. And we kind of keep up with that. But I mean, almost had a Dwarf Fortress feel that way.
Yeah, right. Kind of, and I guess this is where you got your taste for the idea of, you know, building rooms, building a fortress, having enemies outside the gates, sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a standout, interesting, kind of almost experimental game. I'm not sure. I mean, there's four people were involved with it, and I don't know the story. Like, I don't know where this came from, because I mean, there could be predecessors to it, or it could be that they were playing the early roguelikes and saw the maps like this and decided to do a whole new take on them. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if there was no roguelike influence. It wouldn't surprise me if it was like total roguelike influence. It really is. It could be anything. I know some of the roguelikes were before, obviously, and you could push boulders in Hack, but I don't know if the pushing boulders in Hack is before or after this. Like, it's just a fascinating kind of the environmental history of kind of grid-based pushy games. I don't know, but
I think Boulder Dash was the same year, so they you don't know how much crossover there is and how much it's just people coming up with the same sort of concepts concurrently as the technology advances.
No, it's fascinating. That game's definitely
ready to pop the question. The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You and your brother are working on all these games as you move around the country, and you settle on one that is going to become Dwarf Fortress. And, you know, what was it about that game that's, because I know it was very, very different in those early days. What was it that made you think this is the one we want to keep building on?
It was kind of the one that was fun, and it lived in this environment of playing RPGs and roguelikes and stuff at this time that made it kind of like, okay, it's just, I mean, it is bog standard fantasy RPG, but hey, it's fun. And we can do stuff with that. When I got to high school, I learned how to do C, and that opened a lot of doors in terms of making the games more complex. And so we made another version of Drag Slay, which is of course short for Dragon Slayer, if I didn't say that already, that was in C now, and it had a procedural map. It like generated an outdoor map when there weren't very many examples of that. There were some. You just kind of wander around fighting monsters and killing dragons and so forth. And right. It was just super compelling. That game, because it was in C, it was harder to kind of keep alive in a sense. I have the source code, but we really did scuttle it into the ground well, we were still learning how to keep games alive. When I got to college and then grad school, that became the Slaves to Armok God of Blood game, which is like, okay, games are 3D now. We're going to try and make something a little more viable. And we tried to make a 3D game, a 3D RPG that was just an absolute train wreck. Mm-hmm. The idea we knew was good. We knew from Dragslay, the idea was good. It was compelling to have a completely procedural RPG. So we started writing a bunch of side projects at that time, Liberal Crime Squad, World War One Medic, these other games that we just released on this website. One of the side projects we made was going to be one of these beast type games, right? Essentially, you have this game Mutant Miner where you dig downward. That game slowly fell apart for a variety of reasons, and Zach and I had a phone call saying like, okay, we're going to salvage this, turn into a good side project that we finished in a couple months, and we came up with the idea of having, okay, it's a real time game with dwarves. You do some stuff and make some things, get killed as dwarves do when they start digging down there, and then come back with the RPG. Here it comes again, RPG. And your adventure will explore this fortress that you've made. There'll be some generated diaries and stuff as well based on the events of the game. And you get all of the treasures that you made, you bring them outward, and there's your high score. We have a high score in Dwarf Fortress. And that was going to be the game. And that's all one big through line through this kind of fantasy that then became a settlement management game, which is completely at random through this side project. And now that's our thing. That's the main mode. It's very strange, but that's how it turned out.
During this time, you know, like you say, you go on to grad school, and you're obviously a extremely gifted mathematician and had offers from everywhere, wanted you to come and study with them. To what degree did you feel pulled in more than one direction? You know, this part of you that obviously wants to go and make games with your brother. And then I imagine some other expectations on you from educators or lecturers or whoever. You know, did you feel caught in that to a certain degree?
Yeah, kind of. But it was like the games, I had no road forward with that. I never saw that as anything but a hobby.
Right.
So it was more like I was being pulled into the direction of having to support myself as school came to a close and I needed to go get a job. And doing math was like water flowing downhill for me. It was just that was the natural direction to go. And I think like saying that I would be pulled or pushed by educators, it was kind of the opposite. I think they like, certainly my undergraduate advisor could tell something was up. I don't think they knew what it was because I never talked about the games at all.
He's got a secret.
Yeah. If you're good, what they said to me was like, if you're applying to grad school and stuff and to make it as a mathematician, the most important thing is that you have to love it. It's like, you know, that might be an inspirational speech to someone else, but for us, it was like, okay, yes, there's something up here. I know I'm not as dedicated as, I mean, I'm just like I was just doing really well, but I wasn't spending what obviously would have been the extra time, right? Where you go home and you're like, oh, these theorems are so fascinating. I want to read about some more. That was not what was happening. I was going home and I was working on the current iteration of Dragslay and our space games and other games pretty much nonstop.
That's arguably sort of practical maths, right? you're still doing mathematics. It's just you're trying to build something with it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it comes up. The funny thing is I didn't learn linear algebra until quite a bit later. So like the actual practical game math, I was not good at then at that time. And until I started teaching it, when I went to grad school.
And you had to learn it.
Yeah. Although, yeah, I eventually did use some math in the games. I used a differential equation, I think a total of one time.
What was that for?
That was, I believe, for shooting arrows in Armok and getting the wind speed so that you could calculate where it's going to land or something. And then we ended up estimating it anyway, because it's always easier instead of messing with any math. Just estimate and it's fine because no one's going to notice.
Let's come to your third game. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So this is kind of still in the shareware age of these BBSs and things, but now we're not really necessarily on BBSs anymore. I don't actually remember if this is the time when you could start picking things up in a plastic baggie in a store or like on a disc magazine collection. Like there's different ways to get games, right? That aren't box games, and we're not going to get to a box game until the fourth game. So this was Ragnarok. I believe in Europe it might be known as Valhalla. and it's a roguelike game. I decided to put this roguelike game on the list. There's any number of roguelike games that could have been on this list, but this is the one that sticks out. You start, there's a randomly generated play area. You're a single character running around, proving yourself, killing, 4,000 poor creatures or whatever. And then you have some giant goal that you're never going to be able to succeed in doing until you become an expert at the game, right? And so the things that stuck out a bit this one was that the play area was a rendering of Norse mythology. And there were a lot of outdoor maps and just different places. There's like, I don't know how to pronounce anything, but like there's Niflheim and stuff. There's like this icy, hellish place. There's the land where the giants live. And for 1992, that was kind of unheard of, I believe, at the time.
Norse mythology wasn't big in games in the way it is today.
Yeah, and even outdoor maps generation in roguelikes, it was kind of a lightning bolt, basically, in terms of the games we had been playing. It felt very different. And so we could make these stories outside, and I'm just wandering around the forest, and it didn't feel like there was a lot of time pressure. Of course, given the name of the game, there was in fact time pressure, and you're going to have the giant battle at the end of the game, and you're generally just not prepared for it unless you've been doing these quests. There were like five or six quests that you had to complete so that your gods would be able to fight at the end of the game over the Rainbow Bridge. It was intriguing that there would be like literally every character and monster and stuff that was still alive at the end of the game would be in this final battle on this. It was multiple screens of just full of creatures killing each other and gods fighting and stuff. And you have to like deliver the objects that you had to get. Like you had to, like for instance, I don't know if this was even one of them, but if Thor needed a hammer, or the person that got their hand bit off had to get, I don't remember if it was like a hook hand or a real hand or something, right? They're just like, you had to give them all their little things. It's still a game about getting little things and giving them to people, right?
Yeah.
It's, for us though, the interaction with the score lists and stuff kind of had a hack vibe, where you, like in Hack, you could name the creature that killed you before it killed you, and then it would be on the score list. At the top of our score list for the longest time, there's a kind of creature called a jackass, and I don't know what it is. It looks like some kind of quadruped. And as happens in these roguelike games, if you play several times in a row and you continuously die, the name of your character starts to kind of devolve. And you're just like, type a name. So it's sadly at the, and then you have a good run with a character with a terrible name, right?
Yeah.
And so at the top of our list for the longest time was Fucker the Jackass.
That seems like it's more effort to type in than...
Yeah. I mean, you just get...
It's just out of frustration,
It's frustration, exactly. It's not just effort, lack of effort, but frustration. And then, of course, you have the best game you're ever going to play.
And you're labeled with it.
Yeah. And then it's just there staring at you with 10 times the score you're ever going to get it for months. Again, kind of points back to this thing that's sort of a thread through preserving things about the game that you played. Because there's like a direct line from Fucker the Jackass as being in the score list, pointing straight toward Legends Mode in Dwarf Fortress.
Right.
That's how it got there.
Oh, interesting.
And just preserving these things so that you have, not just the frustration when you lose, but the kind of story of what happened, and then you could revisit it. They also have a thing like that in Civilization where you kind of go through the map as it kind of repaints the map for you as when you replay the game and kind of goes through important events. There's just all these different things kind of pointing at thinking about what it means to lose a game.
Yes.
And how you can make that a better experience.
Yeah, and I suppose how you preserve the memory and the myth of that, which is what so much of history is about anyway. How do you do that in a virtual environment and sort of pay tribute to the failed attempts before you, right?
Yeah, and you can do it with graveyards and markers that you can put up. You can do so many things, and people do this now to some extent. I think they can do it a lot more.
It's been interesting to see how board games have tried to introduce that with the legacy sort of versions where the marks of previous games get left on the board for future attempts, don't they? And so you have that memory that's always with you, unlike, like Monopoly, which is just afresh each time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Monopoly, you should start with a player that's better than everyone else, and then you just lose.
Right, yeah. So coming back to the early days of Dwarf Fortress, you've got this idea for a game, like you said, that you send a dwarf down to fetch some stuff and bring it out, and there's a clearly defined start and end. At some point, that shifts to what Dwarf Fortress becomes. How did that happen?
As always happens with a new project, you know, within a week, you're like, oh, wow, this is going really fast, and we've got dwarves running around, we got workshops, we've got them picking up little boulders that they dug in the side of the mountain and bringing them back to the workshop and making crafts out of them, and then, you know, very soon they'll be, like, you know, making tables, making beds, and it's just going so fast. And why is it going fast? It's because we're not rendering a 3D model of a workshop when we're like have no 3D experience, and we're not trying to render 3D dwarves with animations like we had in that the 3D game we made. It just went so fast. It was such a relief and such a revisiting of how our childhood programming worked. There was just no friction at all. And it just started scooping up ideas out of the RPG and putting them into this new environment, this settlement management game. Suddenly they were all there, having all of the little items that they would wear and doing stuff with fluids, the magma and the water, and making bridges over them. But that sense of just taking so little time to do things that had taken so much time before, and how little progress we had made. In 4 years, on this other game, it just consumed all of our old notes and became our main project within a couple of years. It was supposed to be the 2 month project. We started in October of 2002. It was going to be done, finished by Christmas, as usual, right? And no, this was the Great War plus all the other wars all together. No finishing by Christmas. Still going.
Right. I suppose it's that thing where on a creative project where you start to make very rapid progress and it becomes exciting and it's all working as well and feeling good.
Yeah.
You're really the ultimate example of scope creep, aren't you, really, with this game?
Yeah. I mean, there are other examples. Of course, we have I mentioned Unreal World, and NetHack is still going, I guess. Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup is from Lindley's Dungeon Crawl, and that's very old, isn't it? Adam is still here, but it's that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know who's the ultimate example, but we're all very guilty, very, very guilty.
Oh, at what point do you start showing the game to the public?
So we started it in 2002. I don't know if we mentioned it at that time that we were working on it, because normally we'd just drop these things, right? Like, here's Liberal Crime Squad we wrote in 3 weeks. Here's World War One Medic, which was a 2-day game. Get it out there. Don't really talk about it much. People play it. And there's a few. We have a forum at this time. So there's, you know, 20, 30, 40 people
who are following your games, basically.
Yeah, following these games. They're interested in the 3D game, but some fans of the other little games. And so we're like, hey, we're going to make another little game. It's going to be really cool. And then around 2004, when it had started eating up all of our development time, we just made an announcement at some point. It's like, you know, this is kind of our big game now. We're going to start releasing this. We're actually calling it Slaves to Armok, Chapter 2, Dwarf Fortress. That's why the original had such a long name. It's because it was sort of continuing this thread. And it's not untrue, right? It was continuing this fantasy game thread from way back when.
It's so like Dungeons & Dragons fantasy title, isn't it, though? Like, it's...
Yeah, oh, it's terrible.
It's a good job you made it Dwarf Fortress at one point.
Yeah, well, that just happened. That was the Steam release, was when we shortened it to Dwarf Fortress.
Okay.
So for how many years, 18 years or whatever, it's been Slaves to Armok, God of Blood, Chapter 2, Dwarf Fortress, with at least two colons in there. Yeah, no, we're lucky we didn't put one of those like accent marks just in the middle of one of the words, right?
Yeah.
Definitely a fantasy enterprise.
Yeah.
Right around that time in 2004, we put up a GIF on Usenet, which still existed at the time. That was just an ASCII dragon shooting this fire in this animated real-time sequence that was kind of unlike anything that had been out there in the uh-huh. scene before. And we're like, hey, this game's coming. We didn't know that it would be coming in 2 years. But after it had already been in progress for 2 years, but we finally got it out on August 8th, 2006.
Let's come to your fourth game, which I think is from 1994. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So this game is, so we're finally getting to a box store game, you know, and we had these, we had lots of these coming up. We had a bunch of games, you know, we're kind of spoiled again. Like we were talking about, our parents wanted us into computers and the computer games thing stuck, but they used games to do it, much to their regret for several years. This one was one of those. So we got it. Zach and I were both at the University of Washington at the time, not 1994, but when we got it, which would be 1996, Transport Tycoon.
Mm-hmm.
this game sucked us in so bad. Like, during our first, like, when I was just starting school at the University of Washington, like, the first quarter, we got sucked into this game and ended up playing it for something like 40 hours straight, with one of us would be in classes or sleeping or whatever, but the other one would be playing. Just got totally sucked into this making stuff move around and expanding out these different transport networks.
Yeah, so we should explain the game just for any listeners that don't know it.
Well, sorry about that. And so Transport Tycoon has a big, I think, procedural map, or maybe there were just a bunch of options, I don't remember. And there are a bunch of resources and resource users or something, right? So there'd be like a coal mine and a coal power plant or something like that. And your job is basically to connect them up with rail lines or connect up buses, connect up boats. I think there's planes maybe, although I get these games confused because there's quite a few of them. Trucks too, like moving trucks that move freight around or whatever. So you have all of these little named things with a different year that they were made. I believe they had to change to fictitious companies at some point, but it'd be like, here's a bus from, you know, 1928. And you have to maintain it, and then here he goes on its route. Now 20 people are moving here, they're dropped off, and then it moves back. And you have to maintain it every once in a while. There's money in the game, of course, so you can run out of money. The thing with this game is that there's kind of an AI opponent as well, where it's also building a transport network, and you're kind of competing with each other. And we hated that. We hated that so badly that we figured out that what you could do was, if you start the game and spend just a little bit of your money surrounding the enemy headquarters with a railroad track, then they can't do anything. And so then we played it like a sim, like how it was meant to be played.
That's incredible.
And the same thing, we did actually did the same thing with Sim Ant. You could also just put a boulder over the enemy ant mine, just pick up a rock with one of your ants and drop it, and then they're just turned off. And you could just be ants then after that and don't have to worry about it.
I love you just breaking these games just so that you can play them the way you want to. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, it's they finally, like Dolaris, for instance, which is one of these kind of grand strategy space games that Paradox puts out, it finally had a setting for zero AI players.
Right.
Like, thank you so much. Just let me put a zero. If I want to put a zero, I'll play it the other way too. But I'll put the zero there and I could just kind of spread out and read the different stories that you all wrote and stuff and experience the game that way without worrying about kind of falling behind the curve, which is always just the worst feeling for me.
Yes,
Like in those Civilization style games where you discover that there's a continent and they're just better than you. And you already lost. You didn't know that you lost 800 years ago, but you did. And then you just kind of have to experience it, which is fine. But
so you prefer to compete against yourself than against someone else, it sounds like.
Yeah, not really competition at all. Like, I don't think of it as like getting to the end of Transport Tycoon with the most money even, but just kind of experiencing the little trains moving around. It's like having a train set kind of. Right?
Yeah, right.
And Zach and I had a train set when we were little kids, and this was just kind of just watching that happen. In this environment where you can kind of manage everything.
And you don't want the AI competing with you.
No, because you want to set up, like you've been working this whole time thinking about, oh, I'm going to set up this coal connection or something. And then bam, there's a big red track across where you were going to put it. And like, that's not fun.
It's like playing with a kid who's like a total jerk trying to ruin your train set.
Yeah. And it's also got, you know, real life elements. We don't want real life elements in here. Like, no one, other people just spoiling things sometimes. No, just play the game. And we kind of can't play those type of games now just because they were so dangerous and then we just burned out super hard on it. But love little things moving around, you know.
Your game comes out officially in 2006, the available to the public. And then it's a few years later that a reporter from the New York Times magazine comes and writes a big piece about Dwarf Fortress. You know, I'm a journalist, and at that time I remember that piece coming out and it being a really big deal because it was very rare for a mainstream outlet to write a very long literary piece on a video game, let alone one that was quite underground, I suppose, at the time. What was that like when you heard from them and to be featured in such a mainstream way?
Yeah, that was out of the blue too. It was just really, really surprising to hear from them. We've been in a few places by then, right? We'd been on like game oriented sites a little bit, but not really any kind of, we just never thought there'd be any kind of mainstream attention at all. And then they I think probably just sent us an email, just like, hey, interested in doing this story. And And they're like, oh, yeah, and I typically, you know, stay with my subjects for a few days, you know. And so they actually flew out here and, you know, stayed in a hotel or whatever for, you know, I remember it was 3 days or something, and just came over, visited every day. Just talked about the game and stuff. I mean, you quickly abandon this. Like, a lot of people think they're going to be kind of, oh, I'll just be a fly on the wall and watch you work, right? It just does not work with this kind of job, because you're just going to see someone sitting in front of a computer saying, damn it, like every 35 minutes or whatever. It's just like, it quickly doesn't turn into that. And then it just turns into interviews and talking about the game. And that's what the article ended up being, is just this really interesting kind of history of what was going on and how things were going. And
yeah, this was written by, we should say, Jonah Weiner.
Yeah, Jonah Weiner. Yeah. And they just contacted, it's funny because they just contacted me today. They sent an email congratulating me on the,
nice.
We haven't talked for years.
Yeah.
And they're just like, hey, congratulations. And there's been quite a bit of that lately. the congratulations on the launch here. But yeah, at the time, we actually made a little like wall hanging out of like the cover of the magazine and the pictures in there. It was funny because the art department there wanted some kind of like pictures of us that were sort of stylized, and we ended up making ASCII versions of our faces.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. I actually wrote the program that did that.
Nice.
And it was fun to send that along. And then of course, immediately after that was like the Museum of Modern Art, I think probably very related to the fact that we did get into that magazine.
How did your community of players react to sort of having the world's attention on them all of a sudden? Because I know sometimes, you know, communities that are, you know, I suppose over in a corner having their own time over there and, you know, perfectly happy, to suddenly have, you know, this beam of attention on them, it's not always a positive thing, perhaps. But
I think they were happy. No, they were happy. They're happy to see it because, you know, it correlates to how well we're doing. And since we've been publishing our numbers, obviously, and you see a bump or whatever.
Right.
They're just like, great, the game's going to keep going. It was funny too, because I think it mentioned something about us drinking soft drinks in there, which was only half true at the time in the article, because we had left just a bunch of random drinks in there, you know, in case they wanted one. We had no idea what people drank. Obviously, don't just leave out soft drinks for people, but we did. And so they're like, these poor boys, you know, obviously this soda addiction is going to get to them eventually. Yeah, so then the fans were all worried about us after that.
Sending you some like healthy orange juice and stuff.
Yeah. It was interesting because we got that kind of attention just like from New York and stuff before we had met anybody in the industry. It was so strange that like the first industry people we met was actually flying out to Iceland to meet the people that made EVE Online, because they also got into the museum.
CCP.
Yeah, CCP. We also just had like a museum buddies thing during one of their big fan fests. And then we started meeting people after that.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because EVE Online is another game that gets written. It gets covered, obviously, by the video game press, but it also has a lot of attention from mainstream outlets because I suppose it's, you know, doing interesting social things and
Well, the thing is, yeah, even with the big game, the big games get covered sometimes, but they're without the kind of procedural elements, you know, either within Dwarf Fortress, it's kind of inside the game, and in EVE, you've got this MMO style sort of procedural elements of people just making these stories and interacting with each other. There's just more to chew on for a longer period of time, so it can kind of build up.
Yes.
Whereas with a kind of prestige AAA game, you'll have a build up to it and people will play it, but there's not much to say about how people are playing it unless it does have kind of some weird standout element that causes a community that maybe the developers weren't even expecting or something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and I suppose as well, there's the factor of, you know, the people making Call of Duty or FIFA, they don't need to speak to a journalist, are they? They're gonna be fine. Even, you know, not taking any press. So.
Yeah, and I'm sure, I mean, they do probably coordinate stuff and that kind of thing or whatever, and that's just how it's done. Whereas, yeah, with us, we're just kind of waiting for people to reach out. Although that wasn't true of the Steam release. We actually, I mean, Kit Fox did a lot of legwork getting stories together. It's kind of just a big change all
around. Yeah, you're becoming a mega core.
yes, it's our triple I days slowly beginning here.
Okay, yeah, let's, why don't we come to your fifth and your final game? Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so this one I wanted to put in both a game from the 2000s, which I hadn't done, but also just one of my favorite games that is interesting in the way we like things to be interesting, which is Caves of Cud. Caves of Cthulhu is a roguelike game that takes place in the distant future. It's like if you've read the Gene Wolfe novels that take place, you know, billions of years in the future, like The New Sun or that kind of thing. So just a strange mixture of almost fantasy level mutations and things, but just technology as well, right? And beautifully written, which is unusual for a roguelike game, but they have actual writers working on it, and somehow still manages to work with the procedural stuff. And the fact that they've got like text generators thrown in there too, you know, from Markov chains to the more advanced stuff that you see, you know, these days, doing procedural books that you can find, right? And you kind of can play the game also as kind of them. It's not necessarily a permanent death roguelike game where you just play and die and restart, although it has that. You can also have save points and stuff. So there's different ways to play the game, so you shouldn't be frightened off by the roguelike label, which often means that it's going to be a frustrating game. It's just not. And it it's great to see that they started around the same time we did, right? This is a game that began in 2007, and it's kind of approaching its 1.0 on Steam now. It's on Steam, when originally it was just kind of not just distributed through their website and stuff.
Yeah, had early access in 2015, I think.
8 years, right? And so I really dig the setting, dig the kind of presentation, the writing, the soundscape is amazing. There's even a mode of the game where there's no fighting at all. You can just wander through the world and kind of get experience style points that you still need to open up abilities and stuff just from exploring. But you can just kind of chat with people and cook with them and stuff, and it all holds up because the game is written with enough detail for it to hold up, which is a problem that we also have over in our adventure mode, which is not yet released on Steam. It's kind of the RPG part of Dwarf Fortress that we were talking about before. It's like the combat is easy to set up because people understand like people hitting each other, right? It's pretty simple to set up, but anything else you want to do, you suddenly fall into like problems with language or problems with displaying, problems with what's your control scheme or what actions can you do, where you suddenly have to invent it instead of following behind people that came before. And you know, they've made some good strides with this game that we're also kind of trying to do in different directions. It's kind of a standout game in this sort of new procedural direction that things are going, and I wanted to throw it on my console.
Yeah, I think this game was inspired by Dwarf Fortress, but then is in turn, you know, in the ways it's evolved and built on the things that you've done in different ways to how you have, it's now inspiring you back again. How have you felt about, you know, that I suppose the great mini games, most famous of which is Minecraft, of course, that have taken varying degrees of influence from your work?
Yeah, I think it's just part of the process. It's always kind of gratifying, I guess, to see that we have this impact on people, and it's kind of awesome to be at the beginning of what seems like a settlement management game genre explosion. I mean, there's obviously games that came before in the kind of like Caesar walking around type thing or the dungeon keeper type genres. I don't think we really invented a genre. People sometimes say that. I don't think that's quite the case, but it's certainly like we had a huge impact on this, and it's nice to see people in other games too, you know, as far flung as the Sims, you know, out there taking a few little bits and pieces here and seeing homages in World of Warcraft and other places that people obviously play the game a little bit. We all play each other's games and stuff. And it's just great. This whole, you know, conversation we're having is kind of predicated on us having our giant list of games, you know, well beyond five, obviously, that made Dwarf Fortress what it is. And of course, in these conversations, you can also get sucked into like games, inspiring games, as if it's an insulated thing. But, you know, obviously there's everything else.
Other things coming in. I assume you play Dwarf Fortress as well as making it and have your own sort of save and everything. What's the oldest settlement that you've managed to maintain? Do you remember when you started it?
This is funny, but that's not me. I mean, I don't get a chance to play long settlements in Dwarf Fortress because you have to fix things or tweak things that you see, and it gets really frustrating. And then, it's funny because my brother and I set out to, like, let's make a game that we can just play, right? Because it's so procedural that you know, you can surprise yourself. And then, you know, you just get in this position where it's so, it's your job or whatever, and you want to fix things. And
you can't enjoy it. You just see the things that you want to fix.
It's a little different with the RPG because it's so fast. Like Guard of Adventure Mode, you don't survive very long because there's no hit points generally. Yeah, so that we could do. And we'll try and get that out on Steam this year if we can. And then maybe I'll be able to get back into my own game. It'd be cool. I like it. I think it's pretty cool.
Okay, so you've got on your console, we've got Cosmic Ark, Beast, Ragnarok, Transport Tycoon, and Caves of Kud. Have I said that right?
I'm not sure they even know how to say it. Kud is what people usually say, but people can say as they like.
So I'm going to put you on the spot slightly. We need to come up with a name for your console that we're going to package it in and sell it to the world. Have you got an option for us?
I was thinking that it would just make sense to call it the Losing is Fun console.
Yes. So that's, of course, the tagline from Dwarf Fortress. Losing is fun.
Losing is fun. And I think with all of these games, except for Transport Tycoon, losing is fun. But like Transport Tycoon sticks out as maybe losing's not fun there. Maybe we'll that's like the bonus game or something. But yeah, Cosmic Ark is like even though the game you just get hit by asteroids or something, there's still. It feels like you're ending a story. It's like it's still good to eventually get blasted out of space. Beast, of course, we talked about how great it was to lose. Not if you play it traditionally, losing is not as fun, but if you play it non-traditionally. Ragnarok and Caves of Cut are both roguelikes, and losing is fun is baked into the DNA of roguelikes. Because you'll tell stories about how terrible you played, and yet another stupid death, as they call it, right? Yeah, I think it's a good dance.
Okay, the Losing is Fun console. Okay, sounds good. Just before I let you go, you said right at the beginning of the conversation that sort of your path that you took, you know, your career is sort of unreplicable in a way, because I suppose it's, you know, the things that have happened that have enabled Dwarf Fortress, you know, are of their time in some way. But what might you say to a pair of young brothers who are coming up with stories and maybe wanting to start making their own games? How might you encourage them to find their way to some taste of the success that you've enjoyed?
You have to keep making games. I mean, there's really no substitute for practice. And then, you know, monetizing, like just don't worry about it right now. Just try and keep it as a side gig is what I would do for until you feel like you can see a path forward. Like we did when, like, because things changed so much. Like, if we had tried to monetize Dwarf Fortress in, you know, 1995 or something, we would have been shipping it out with, like, paper-printed manuals and stuff, which would not have really worked for us, I think. But when we put out the game was right when we had things like PayPal tip jars, which is what we survived on for a couple of years. Just the tip jar. And then subscriber services like Patreon and stuff came up, and then we got on that, and that became our main source of income. And then, of course, Steam after that. And the Steam, like for us, Steam would not have been an option that was super viable from the beginning. But because of games that we've, you know, alluded to here, like RimWorld, Nemoria, Prison Architect, there's a large base of Steam players ready to play Dwarf Fortress, and they know the conventions. You just have to be mindful. I mean, you have to be mindful and smart about what you're doing, learn how to interact with online communities and build an online community. That's how we got started. And it's difficult to do these days. The conditions are so different. Like discoverability is so hard these days.
Yeah,
whereas
right.
Before we could put up our webpage and somehow like these search engines just kind of found it, right? And then people came immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
It only took like a few days and people were on our forum and
people
stuff.
People would Google cool game and they'd arrive at your website.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, there's my website is number 9 on Altamira or Lycos or something, right? Or whatever. But the thing is, you know, that doesn't mean there's not a path forward for people who are starting now. It just means you have to look for it, and it's going to, you know, be potentially very difficult, like it was for us in ways, where I mean, I kept this job that I didn't like for quite a long time. You know, that's, I mean, we're privileged in a lot of ways, that, you know, we have to keep that in mind, obviously. Like people aren't just like trained on computers as kids generally, although maybe they are now.
Not in the same way, I don't think. Yeah. You're fairly unique.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, Yeah, that's just, I mean, there's a lot of things that add up like that, but at the same time, I don't think it's hopeless for people. There's a lot of people that have kind of entered indie games, and are still here. A lot of people are not going to make it. Like, there's a lot of games that just launch on Steam and sell, you know, 20 copies and that's it. But so I'm not sure who I'm speaking to here, because like, if I were speaking to myself, it just wouldn't matter because you couldn't stop me from trying.
Right. Yeah. Maybe that's the key.
Yeah. I mean, it could have gone badly, obviously. I mean, when I quit my math job to work on Dwarf Fortress, it was before Dwarf Fortress was even released. I didn't care. That could have ended immediately and badly.
It's the kind of decision you can only make at a certain point in your life, isn't it? When you're, you know, young, basically, and fewer responsibilities, at least. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, brilliant. I've absolutely loved talking to you. So thank you so much for your time, and for coming on, and for sharing your story and your games with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with the format too.
Oh, thanks, Todd. Thank you to my guest, Tarn Adams, co-creator of Dwarf Fortress. When I was preparing to speak to Tarn, I went back and reread Jonah's piece in the New York Times Magazine about Dwarf Fortress, written in 2011. And it's a wonderful piece of writing. I will tweet it out, but you can search for it. And I wrote to Jonah just to tell him how much I enjoyed that piece, both at the time and returning to it now. And he sent me a message back and saying, "That's one of my favourite things I've written, in no small part because I've never met anyone like Tarn and Zach. Tarn's a true eccentric genius and very sweet. It couldn't have happened to two cooler people." And I think having listened to Tarn talk about his journey and his game, I think probably most of us today would agree with that assessment. Thank you for listening this far into the podcast. Thank you to those of you who have been writing in to suggest future guests. Please continue to do so. You can send me messages at myperfectconsole@gmail.com or on Twitter at myperfectconsole, with the O's removed from console. You can also find me on Twitter at Simon Parkin. If you would like to support the podcast financially, then please head to Acast Plus, search for My Perfect Console, and there'll be a little button where you can become an early access supporter. You will get episodes 24 hours before they go out to the public, and also a guarantee of not having any streaming ads as well. And that's for just £3 a month, I think. So less than £1, $1 per episode. But of course, there's all sorts of demands on our time and money these days. So don't feel any pressure. Just enjoy the podcast in whatever way feels appropriate. And I'm just glad to have you along for the ride. We will be back next week with a new guest, and there are 5 games and 1 more perfect console. Until then, have a wonderful week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.